You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Before he achieved international success as a filmmaker, Oliver Stone had been wounded as an infantryman in Vietnam and spent years writing unproduced scripts while driving taxis in New York until he finally ventured westward to Los Angeles and a new life. After winning an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay for Midnight Express in 1978, he was one of the hottest writers in Hollywood, but he soon learned how fickle the movie business could be. So Oliver Stone said to hell with the studios and independently funded, wrote, and directed two of his best films back-to-back in the same year. One movie about an overlooked civil war in El Salvador, and Platoon, which would earn him his second Academy Award, this time for directing. Now Oliver Stone has written about that crucible year in his career and the four decades that led up to it in his new book, Chasing the Light, writing, directing, and surviving Platoon, Midnight Express, Scarface, Salvador, and the Movie Game. And today, this controversial and outspoken filmmaker joins me on the podcast to discuss why he dropped out of Yale and volunteered to go fight in the war in Vietnam at a time when most young men were trying to get college deferments to avoid the draft, some of the horrors he witnessed during that war, and why he credits the black soldiers in his platoon with having opened his eyes to injustice and indeed saving his life. He recalls writing the script for Scarface while trying to kick his own cocaine addiction, his wild adventures with the journalist who inspired his movie Salvador, and how that film awakened him to America's role in propping up Central American dictators. He talks about why it took him 16 years to get Platoon made, how the ouster of Filipino strongman Ferdinand Marcos nearly shut down production on that movie, and why he felt it was essential to the film to put his actors through a grueling 2 weeks of combat training. Plus, the hardest part about shooting a movie in the jungle, what he learned from his NYU film professor Martin Scorsese, and why he learns as much from his successes as he does from his failures. Coming up with Oscar-winning writer-director Oliver Stone in just a moment. Oliver Stone is the multiple Oscar-winning writer-director of Platoon, JFK, Born on the 4th of July, Natural Born Killers, Midnight Express, and many other films. He's out with a new memoir titled Chasing the Light, Writing, Directing, and Surviving Platoon, Midnight Express, Scarface, Salvador, and the Movie Game. Oliver Stone, welcome.
Thank you, Ben.
I have to say, your book titles are nothing like your movie titles. Your movie titles, Scarface, one word, Platoon, JFK, Nixon.
No, this is my title. Chasing the Light is my title. I think right. The publisher and the editor wanted to. Who is this guy? Is he a religious nut or what? So they put a subtitle on to. Also, they play, you know, in this crazy game of the world right now, you have the more words you can put in a title, it comes up on word search.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I never thought about that. Now, you have had just such a prolific career with some truly great movies to your credit, but this book specifically focuses on your first 40 years leading up to this crucible moment in, I think, 1986, when your directing career begins in earnest, and you made two films back-to-back, Salvador and Platoon. Why did you choose to focus on those first four decades?
Well, because a lot happened. And the reason I wrote the book was I reached a certain age and I had it in me. I really wanted to explain and explore what happened in that time period, because it was an amazing experience, but it was a very fast experience. I mean, once the Midnight Express gets rolling, the train moves very fast. And sometimes you just don't have time to appreciate, stop, smell the roses or whatever you want to call it. But I really, by going back and living in that world for almost 2.5 years, re-exploring and becoming conscious of things that happened. Now, in that regard, I learned a lot writing the memoir, truly. And I think everybody should review their life at some point. I think know thyself is the Socratic terminology, but I had a diary to help me. Now, it was a little spotty in the 70s because my life was a little spotty, but it comes into being more in the 80s, and then I have it from then on to the end. And it's just too thick a story. But the whole idea was that I realized a dream that I had when I was young, which was to be somebody, to achieve a success in the arts, and movies was a dream. It was a dream. And I realized the dream at the age of 39, 40, when I made those two films back to back. I got my place in Hollywood, so to speak. And it's like a novel. I mean, I tried to keep that in mind. It opens at 30. I'm broke. I'm depressed in New York City. The bicentennial years are going on, July 4th celebration. New York is crazy, but I'm the opposite. I'm just totally depressed. And I go into that, and like, it weaves back into a family history, which is kind of volcanic, into the 40s, 1940s, 50s, 60s. A divorce happens. My parents were very volatile, but interesting people. And then it goes to Vietnam twice. It goes to colleges. It goes into the movie business and being broke in New York again after the war, going to prison, being in New York and writing screenplays, being rejected, rejection, rejection, failures, and then Midnight Express. But what happens is at the age of 30, I've written all these screenplays. I've written 12 by that time. So at the age of 30, I'm about to give up. And what it goes into the reasons why I go on and make it to 40. By the time I'm 40, the whole thing is turned around.
You mentioned your parents' divorce a moment ago, and I enjoyed reading about them. They were both very interesting people. Your dad had been a writer and a stockbroker on Wall Street, and he was an aide to General Eisenhower during the war. And I guess that's where he met your mom, who was this very social and sophisticated French woman. Who do you take after more, your mom or your dad?
Oh, man, you're getting into the heart of it. There's a tremendous split in my nature. First of all, you realize that I'm a writer director, so I'm trying to make the point about the split. My father was a writer, a logical man. My mom was a party girl and wonderful, loved people. And so in a sense, she became my inspiration to be a director. I mean, to be out there in the world. But it's two different natures. One's very introverted, the other one's extroverted.
And the Vietnam War has played a big role in your life. You talked at length about the influence that it's had on your life and your work and who you became as a person. And I have to say, you're an interesting cat, Oliver Stone, because here you were at the height of the Vietnam War. Most American males were trying to get college deferments so they could get out of the draft. And you did the opposite. You dropped out of Yale and chose not to go back. And instead, you go to Vietnam and specifically ask to be a regular grunt in the infantry, even though you probably could have gotten a cushier post through some connections with your dad. Why were you so eager to fight?
Well, there are multiple reasons. I mean, my father was a very strong Republican influence in my life, believed in, honor, duty, country. And I felt like the communist menace was at the gates in East Asia, and I went for it all lock, stock, and barrel.
Okay, you were a true believer back then.
Yeah, but there was another reason too, and you have to take that into account, is that I had written a book. I was a writer in my bones, and I had written a big book for myself. At 19 years old, after coming back from Vietnam in the Merchant Marine and being a teacher for two terms in Asia, in Saigon, I wrote this book about my first, it was the first expression of my feelings that I'd ever had, and it was an explosion. And in a sense, I came to believe in myself. I existed after this divorce. You have doubts about what your family life means and what your life means. And I think it was a way to reassert myself. I existed, so to speak, on paper, not in, I still wasn't a person that was formed. I was forming. Writing that book really released a lot of energy tension. But when it was submitted in 1966, it was rejected. That broke my heart. And I had given up college. I'd given up everything. I felt like I was on the wrong path in my life, that I had was a narcissist and I completely overstated my claims and felt like I needed to be punished, humbled. I was troubled. I was very dark moods and suicidal. And
so you had a little bit of a death wish, huh?
Yes, exactly. And I don't think a lot of adults take that seriously when you're an adolescent, but it really exists.
Yeah.
So I did go with a sense of, let God sort this out, you know, let him roll the dice. I got to see what happens, because if I deserve to live, I'll come out. If I don't, we'll find out. And frankly, I didn't bitch about it. I mean, it was rough over there. The moment I got into combat, I realized how rough it was. But I never regretted my decision. I was a fatalist in that way.
Now, you've talked before about the bond that you had with the black soldiers in Vietnam, and we see that in Platoon. What kind of influence did they have on you personally, and maybe also in terms of how you perceived that war and maybe even America as a whole?
When I got to Vietnam, what I saw was, put it this way, a lot of the black soldiers, not all, I bonded with them because I agreed with them. I had a contempt for authority and the reasons we were fighting the war. I just instinctively, we felt that. We didn't protest or anything. What we did was smoke dope, listen to music back in the base camps, and hang out. And it was that bond, that brotherhood. And they let me in. At that time, they saved my life, because otherwise, I think I would have dried up. I think the cruelty, the brutality of that war, the callousness, the racism against the Vietnamese, mm-hmm. against the Vietnamese. You see the scenes in the book, the way we interact with the civilians over there. It's hard on the soul. Mm-hmm. I think I would have really coarsened in a way that I didn't want to. And so it saved my life in the sense that you need relationships. You need humanity in war. You need to have brothers. You need to stay in touch with your heart, because so much happens and covers it up. And also, I would say the black soldiers in general had a contempt for authority, the man, so to speak, you know, like the white figure, the bully, the guy who was telling them what to do all the time.
Yeah.
They were not anti-war as much as they were anti-authority. And I had problems in the Army. I got busted a few times, for disciplinary reasons.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, I volunteered. I extended my stay in Vietnam in combat. I went an extra 3 months to get out of the Army sooner. When I came back stateside, I wanted to kill off the last six-month obligation. So I extended 3, and I got out 3 months early.
I've heard at some point, I guess the CIA tried to recruit you when you were over there, and I guess that could have been your ticket out of the infantry. You turned them down. Can you talk about that? Is that true?
Now, that was a story that surfaced years ago, because when I taught school there in 1965 at the age of 19, I went over there alone, didn't know anybody, grew a beard, and really melted into the population in Chalon. And that school was a strange school, because it was a Catholic, heavily Catholic school, privately financed out of Taiwan. Now, Taiwan was a big anti-communist island and country, and they wanted to influence the population. So they were teaching a rigid kind of anti-communism. And I was teaching history and mathematics, so I wasn't involved in all that, but I heard later from one of the students that there was quite an influence. They were involved with the CIA, that the church was involved, the Catholic Church was, and so forth. And the school was one of their schools in Asia, but I didn't know that. So I don't, that's not called recruiting. I just happened to work for a school that was suspect.
Okay.
The problem with the school, it's a funny story. You'll get a kick out of this. I mean, if you go to school, you know how hard it is. And I really took my job seriously. I prepared. I had to grade 50, 60 papers. I mean, it was like 5 classes, I guess, 300 papers a week practically. And the kids were really hard workers, some of them, and some were really lazy, lazy beyond belief, and there was no hope for them ever learning anything. So I'd flunk about 20% of the students, because that's the way I was trained at Yale, you know, or at boarding school. I flunked 20% of the students. Then I come back the next term, and I will go into my class, and that 20% has been promoted to the next class, you see. And I threw my hands up, and I said, what the fuck is going on? I go to the headmaster, who was a very cold, ascetic Chinese man, and he said, don't worry about it, you know. And I found out later that the reason the school was on the ropes, you know, they needed the money from the Chinese Vietnamese business community to keep going. So the parents, of course, would bribe bribe the school, pay extra money to get the kid promoted.
Now, yeah, I have to say, it's hard to picture you as a CIA spook. That would have been a very different life, I imagine.
Well, they've accused me of that. But no.
Oh, yeah. Have they?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's the nutcases in this country that say, oh, he made JFK, and he's actually a spook. You know, I don't know how they come up with that theory.
Let me ask you this. You're clearly a man who doesn't just buy into the accepted narrative of history or the government's version of things. And we see this in many of your films like Snowden, JFK, Nixon, W, and also Salvador. Where does this distrust of the deep state or the establishment or whatever you want to call it come from? Is that just typical of someone who came of age in the Vietnam and Watergate era, or is it something deeper in you?
Well, it's a good question. What do you think? I'm just curious.
Well, I guess many people would say that it was, just something that came with, having lived through the JFK assassination, Vietnam, Watergate. You seem to have a particular interest in conspiracy theories and, state and that kind of thing. Right. Conspiracies. Okay. I'm just wondering if that goes to something deeper.
It's a broad question, but you have to keep in mind my generation, born in 1946, right after the war. I grew up in a country that was freaked out by the Red Scare. I mean, we'd had a big Red Scare back in 1919, huge, and we deported a lot of people, and we passed a lot of stupid laws. We've had a lot of stupidity about Russia in our country, and it continued heavily after World War II. And my father, because he'd been a lieutenant colonel in the Eisenhower staff on financial affairs, and he'd seen a lot of chicanery in the financial, in Berlin and in Paris, he'd been there, and the counterfeiting of the American dollars. There was all kinds of stuff going on. So the Russians, he really distrusted the Russians, and so did all America. So when I actually went back and studied all this period under when I made Untold History of the United States with the professor from American University, Peter Kuznick, I had a real chance to spend time. The era that I grew up in was overshadowed by the need to build up our military, to spend huge amounts of money to make a military economy, and the Russians were infiltrating America. They were in our schools. They were going into our State Department. The McCarthy era was incredibly ignorant, and they attacked so many people, ruined so many careers, not only Chinese experts, Soviet experts. There was a dread in America that we never hardly got over. And it didn't go away, really, until Nixon sort of loosened it up in the 70s. But then Reagan brought it back, and then it finally went away with Gorbachev in 1986. And when they had a wonderful relationship, and they started to denuclearize. Mm-hmm. So I grew up that way. I'm trying to make the point that in my generation, though, there was other people. Where did George Bush come from? Where did Donald Trump come from? Oh, they were born the same time I was. Mm-hmm. Bush was in my class at Yale. Trump was a parallel of that era. But they grew up in the same environment, but they never questioned the conventional thinking of the time. Mm-hmm. I think because of my upbringing, I had the chance to. My father was, rigid in that way, but he was also an intelligent man. We had arguments, debates about movies, about Russia. I was always questioning, but I never really was. I was a conformist, too.
So what was the turning point or the aha moment for you when you realized that your government maybe wasn't always acting in your interests? Sometimes leaders lie, they cover up crimes or prop up some pretty bad guys in the world. Did that dawn on you when you were fighting in Vietnam or when?
I came back from Vietnam alienated, but not looking at the big picture. And I write about that in the book, and about how over the 70s, the course of the Watergate, as you say, and certainly Jane Fonda and those people and all the protesters, I did listen. And I admired people like who spoke up, William Sloan Coffin, people who went to jail, Benjamin Spock. I admired them from a distance. Bertrand Russell, don't forget Bertrand Russell. Oh, yeah. I admired that kind of boldness.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment.
And the way you describe it in the book, it also sounds like directing the movie Salvador wasn't just a turning point in your career, but it really opened your eyes to the kind of highly questionable things that our government and the CIA were doing, such as propping up dictators, assassinating leaders we didn't like, covertly funding wars, etc. Of course, all under the guise of fighting communism. Tell us about that.
The climax of the whole thing comes, I'm out again, I'm outside the system again, I'm starting over. And I decide to make my own film, and at any cost. Mm-hmm. So I fly down to Salvador, which is in Central America, with Richard Boyle, crazy Irish journalist, Irish American journalists. And he takes me on a series of adventures there that are unbelievable. We write about them in the book. It's a civil war going on, and here we are trying to make a movie, and with no money except the money I was raising off my mortgages and stuff. I was newly married. I had a baby. My mother, I was dependent on me. It was crazy for me to do this. And I talk about what happened and how much I almost got buried there. It would have been wiped out. But it was that when Richard took me on that trip, 85, to Salvador, early 85, and Nicaragua, not Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, and Costa Rica, I saw the creeping militarization in the region. American soldiers and military people. Now there were women. So it's a whole different story here. This is Honduras. We have troops there, National Guard, Reserve troops, TDY, all kinds of illegal maneuvering is going on, and spooks everywhere. Mm-hmm. Costa Rica. Certainly Honduras was a hotbed, and Salvador too. Yeah. They were breaking the law constantly. The idea, the goal was to destroy the government of Nicaragua, which mm-hmm. had just a revolutionary government, the Sandinistas. So there was an ugly war starting to happen down there, very ugly.
Richard Boyle sounds like a real character. And I yep. love the stories of when you went down to Central America to scout locations with him. Tell us a little about that guy.
He was a Hunter Thompson type. He was a journalist, and he devil may care. He did anything to make some money, get a story. He was total, but he never believed. He was the last guy out of Cambodia. I mean, they always taking risks. He was in Ireland. He was in Beirut. He went to all the hot spots. Took great chances. His scheme was ridiculous. His scheme was, and I was so desperate at that time, and he convinced me of it. He said, "Well, we're going to get the Salvo government, which is heavily right wing. That we're going to get the Salvadoran government to put up the dough for us to shoot half the picture here. We're going to show the bad guys as the communists. You know, the rebels. What Reagan was saying." We're going to have helicopters. We're going to have 25 helicopters all over. It's going to be Apocalypse Now for 50 grand. Sounds great. I fell for it. And we got permission, actually, from the Salvadoran military, which is some story. And then our advisor got killed, our public relations guy. Yeah, he got shot in the head in the tennis court down there. But, and Richard's plan, of course, the end of the plan was to finish the last half of the film in Mexico. Mm-hmm. where we'd shoot the rebels as the good guys. So we were betraying the Salvadoran government. They got wind of it eventually, and they really went after us, which I talk about, and they hurt us too. But
I have to say, it was pretty ballsy of you to make a movie that was critical of the war in El Salvador and U.S. intervention, not just in El Salvador, but in that entire region, just as you know, it was the Reagan era, and Ronald Reagan was pushing, you know, for U.S. backing to the Contras. Did you feel a little bit like your film was a risky message to be trying to sell at that particular time?
That's for sure. Nobody wanted it. No American distributor ever did anything with that picture. They rejected it outright. So it was distributed, if you remember, by a small English company called Hemdale, But the point was that it was here that I took a stand. It was like saying, okay, I've been to Vietnam. I've seen this before, and I'm seeing it again. This is Vietnam Redux. Why is America taking this position against the honest people of these countries and supporting these shit governments, generally death squads, consisting of death squads in Guatemala that killed so many people in Guatemala and in Salvador? They killed, who knows? I mean, it's a huge number in Salvador.
We'll
they
never know.
Any trade union activist, any dissident of any kind, they killed any sort of reformers. They even went after religious people, nuns. They killed the Archbishop of Salvador, the leading figure, Romero. And we showed that in the movie. It was an ugly war. I mean, a lot of torture, brutality, always is. I mean, it was like the beginning of Vietnam. They did the same thing, the South Vietnamese government, after anybody who was against, who was for the reform in South Vietnam. They killed them.
A moment ago, you mentioned the British independent film company Hemdale, which ended up financing both Salvador and Platoon as a package deal. It was run by a somewhat legendary producer named John Daly, and you give him a lot of credit for taking a chance on you. Tell us a little about him.
He was quite a guy. He was a real buccaneer. I mean, he had been a boxing promoter, one of the promoters of the Ali fight in the Congo in the Zaire, and he'd been jailed for that, too. You know, he'd been around, too. He'd been a merchant seaman like I had.
Oh, yeah.
Tough guy, but a real cockney, you know, like Michael Caine, your guest. I mean, came from the streets, so he had that sensibility. A real guy. He wasn't a phony producer type. I loved him. He died young, but I loved him. He was, of course, was sued into bankruptcy. He had so many lawsuits at the end of his life. He was a funny man.
Well, and I know in years since, Salvador has been somewhat overshadowed by Platoon and your later studio films. But I have to tell you, I watched it again the other night, and it's a damn good movie. It really does hold up well all these years later.
Well, it's fun because, and it's also because we made it fun too and entertaining. Richard is an entertaining guy.
Yeah.
So he says things that are outrageous in the movie. They're politically incorrect. Okay, but we love that too, in the way that we love Hunter Thompson or we love Cheech and Chong. You know. And that was our idea going into the movie. Let's make it wild and raucous and unlike a politically correct movie.
Yeah, and Belushi's great in that movie.
We have so much violence and sex that, you know, there's no way we could get that through the system. But it was important for me to do that, to make a statement, because I'd been attacked before that on Scarface, on Year of the Dragon, on Midnight Express. I was attacked vociferously by some critics for being racist, xenophobic, all that stuff, which I was not. So I felt like this was a chance as a director to make a statement, statement about what I felt.
Yeah.
I thought it was my last film too, by the way. I thought, this is it. I'm never going to work again.
Yeah. Having rode that wave up and down in Hollywood at that point, how much was riding on Salvador? Did you feel like it was a make or break moment for you?
Oh yeah. This was it. Now when I hit 1985 and I said, I got to do something outside the Hollywood system, it's not going to work for me. I mean, I've been through hell. I told you about I wrote about my struggles with Platoon. I'd written that in 76. It was, and they almost made it twice. And, you know, and I just gave up after a while. And so this was it. I had to take a stand. And I seemed like I could do Salvador at a very low number when I first read the Richard story of it. But I was crazy. Yeah. There's no way to make a picture with 93 speaking parts, helicopter attacks, death squads, massacres. You can't make them. And we had, all the way through, we had problems. And they're funny problems sometimes. We're about to start to make the film, just about to start finally. And of course, the Mexican government devalues the fucking peso at that very moment. God. We lose 20% of our budget.
You have this amazing moment where you get to direct two movies back to back, and you had been trying to make Platoon for, gosh, 16 years, I think. And it's funny because I love how you say that at first the studios years back were telling you that no one wanted to see the Vietnam War on the screen. It's too dark. It's too soon. You know, and then suddenly The Deer Hunter, Coming Home, and Apocalypse Now come out, all big hits. And then they say, oh, the Vietnam War has already been done. It's played out.
In a way, you're right. Yeah, it wasn't quite like that, because Coming Home was not a hit. It was financially.
Oh, was it? Okay.
It was too down. And that hurt us very much, because I had also written more on the 4th of July at that point.
And
that was another reason they killed it. But the other two, Apocalypse and Deer Hunter, were mythic, large canvases, epic films. I enjoyed them, but they were not realistic to what happened on the ground over there. So that was lacking. And then on the other side of the spectrum was Sylvester Stallone with his inflated ego making these Rambo pictures, and which were awful. I mean, except the first one was not bad. But there was this beef, like, you know, let us go back and fight the war again. We had the hand tied behind the back, the politicians. It's the old German story from World War One. You know, we couldn't fight the war our way. Well, come on, we couldn't have won it except by nuking them. And I doubt that even that would have worked, because they're fighters. The Vietnamese are really fighters. I mean, warrior ants for independence. They don't give up. Curtis LeMay was insane, and that kind of thinking would not work.
Yeah.
But there was Rambo, and there was also Chuck Norris, another Texas Ranger type, you know, who's going to go over there and be the justice, the guy who brings justice to the world. You know, all that crappy thinking is really, that vigilante thinking is off base, and it's part of the American problem that we have.
And I love some of the stories of the things that went on behind the scenes on Platoon and the hurdles you had to overcome. In fact, wasn't the film almost canceled because you were shooting in the Philippines just as Ferdinand Marcos was ousted?
Yeah. Finally, after 10 years, I get a chance to make the damn movie and really want to make it. They're actually giving me the money. The money's there. The schedule's set. It's going to be easier than Salvador, it looks like. And then right at that moment, Marcos, after 20 years of dictatorship, is ousted. The whole thing is up in the air again.
Yeah, and I think that you said that Marcos's military had given you guys permission to use all these helicopters and tanks and all these things.
Yeah.
And so you had to renegotiate with the new government.
That's correct. But, you know, it's also at the very same moment Salvador opened in New York and didn't do so well. So you could imagine my heart was in the toilet.
What's the hardest part about filming a movie in the middle of a jungle?
We found out, didn't we? We broke all the rules, frankly, but I don't know that had ever done what we had done, which is take cameras in so deep into the jungle where the moisture, you have to deal with the moisture and sometimes the heat. And at night, you have to deal with insects that are very loud. And we learned everything as we went. It was on the job training. We built sets or whatever you call, you know, built camps that we photographed way up in the mountains, sometimes several thousand feet. And we were a long way from any base. So I loved it that way because it was real guerrilla filmmaking.
Yeah.
Bob Richardson and I, Bob was my director of photography, wonderful man. We had been through hell on Salvador. He'd seen everything. It was his first film. So this is our second film and together. And it was like, we learned as we went and we built our confidence. But really it was just, I mean, half the crew got sick over the course of Platoon because it was a tough film to shoot. And there were days that 50% of crew, we had to film with 50% of the crew sick down.
Yeah, and you actually hired Captain Dale Dye to put the cast through a few weeks of very, very intense combat training. I can't imagine how many times SAG would have pulled the plug on you if this had actually been a SAG movie. What'd you put those poor guys through?
You know the rules, and you're smart. I mean, SAG rules are very tough. They have 12-hour turnarounds. There was no way we could put our actors into a jungle setting for training camp. And my directive to Dale was, I don't want them to sleep. I want them to really be on the edge of their nerves. They should look exhausted when they come on screen, tired, nervous, irritated. And that's when he got them to that place. There was very little rest, which is the way I remember Vietnam.
Yeah. I had Willem Dafoe on a while back, and he actually said that what you put them through was very helpful. He said it was essential to the movie, in fact.
No. Yeah. I don't think it would have been as effective. You know? But certainly SAG would have closed us down in the States, and they probably closed us down now. I mean, there's no way you can make these kind of movies. I was blowing all the explosives because the special effects guys were shorthanded, and they needed to be out with the wiring, and I was blowing them. And no director would do that now.
Yeah. What do you think about Hollywood now with all the rules, and now you got to have a COVID? I think you said something about this. You have to have a COVID consultant on set and everything else.
Well, I heard their intimacy advisor too.
for intimate scenes.
Yeah. For male, female scenes, I guess, you know, wow. You know, it's gotten really specialized, and I think it's dangerous. It's specialization in anything where it becomes over-specialized.
Yeah.
Makes it very difficult to actually, first of all, to make a film is very hard and takes enormous effort from so many people. Mm-hmm. And it's just another layer. It's another layer of difficulty. You know, more power to them. I hope they make good films this way, but it'll be more expensive and it'll take longer.
And in addition to putting your cast on Platoon through some pretty hellish combat training, you actually admit in your book to having been, in your own words, abusive to the crew on that film. And I know that at times you've gotten branded, rightly or wrongly, as quote unquote difficult to work with, maybe combative with studios, hard on actors, et cetera, et cetera. At this point, do you just have to own that side of yourself, or how do you respond to that stuff?
I would own up that I got Platoon was so difficult, as was Salvador, that there are times you can't take it anymore. You snap like any human being would snap.
Sure.
But I had to be cool. I had to stay cool. Otherwise, I couldn't have done 10 films in 10 years of that complexity if I'd been an asshole.
Yeah.
there are times you just kind of watch yourself. You do want to kill somebody on Platoon when it's your script. You have 50 to 54 days to make it. Every hour counts. In the jungle, the light goes down. That's why Chasing the Light, the title, you're chasing the light. You have to get it done. And what people don't realize is that if a fire truck doesn't show up and you have to lose 2 hours, or they screw up and you don't move the crane the night before, you lose time. Mm-hmm. That time comes out of the script. If there's nobody else, there's no insurance. I mean, that doesn't really work, because you're not going to go an extra day over the 54-day limit. That's mm-hmm. it. Also, you've got to get out of there. And the monsoon season was coming.
Yeah.
So every time that happened, it was like taking a piece out of me. How am I going to shoot this scene now? What do I have to cut out of the scene to make this work so I need fewer shots? This is always a debate going on, by the way, all through my career till the very end. But I do think I had a lot of fun on the sets, and I had very good relations with most everybody. There's a few that didn't work out, but I worked with a lot of different actors. But I had very good relations. And I think we did a hell of a good job of rehearsing, too, rehearsing very complicated stuff and getting good performances from judging from Academy Award nominations and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think that the average person understands how the job of director requires you to be so singularly focused on just getting the movie made, and how no one else on that project has as much invested in it as
That's
the
right.
director does. And in fact, there's something that you say in here earlier in the book. When you were in film school, you actually had a young Martin Scorsese who was teaching you, and he said, to make a good film, it has to be personal for you. Is that still the case? Do you feel that every film that you make today is still personal?
You have to find your way into it to make it matter to you.
Yeah.
It has to matter to this pace of passion. If you don't have the passion, I suppose you can do it. Mm-hmm. I suppose you can do it, but it hasn't worked for me. That's not to say you're going to live on the edge of your breath all day through all those films. You have to find your pace. But so much work, so fatiguing. It's not only it's the writing, the directing, and the editing, and also working the release. You have to go out and publicize and talk about it. So it's a long haul. You don't start that process unless you love this project to the death. And I mean, really marry it. It's a marriage. It's not like a dating, you're not dating the movie.
Yeah.
That won't last. This has to go the distance.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I say every one of those films is like a baby,
Yeah. Well, we sort of skipped over some of the films that you did in the 70s that you wrote but didn't direct. And as we start to wind down here, I do want to bring up Scarface. I was kind of surprised to find out that as you were trying to kick your own cocaine habit, you were writing the screenplay for Scarface. Was it hard to stay sober when you're writing a movie that's entirely about the coke trade?
I researched the movie on cocaine, and I talk about cocaine because it was around in Hollywood heavily in the 70s and certainly into the 80s. And I got, at first I did it as a party drug, as an energizer, no problem. But at a certain point after The Hand really came out in 1981, I got hooked. Mm-hmm. And by that I mean addicted. And I think addiction is when you need something, it controls you. You don't control it. and I lost control of my, I wasn't myself in my writing, I thought degenerated. And I talk about it, I think, frankly, in the book. And that was during the period when I was offered Scarface. So I did the research in Florida and the Caribbean with cocaine dealers, with all those people on, you know, I was one of them. And I had a very hairy scene, as I described in Bimini, where I almost got, my wife and I almost got offed by, I thought we were going to get killed by a couple of dealers, major dealers.
Wow.
In other words, I experienced the tension of that trade, of what it's like. But when I went to Paris to write, I went to Paris deliberately to write it, because I knew there was nobody in Paris on that drug that could influence me. I didn't want to be around people. That's the danger of it. It's always the people in your social circle. Mm-hmm. So I wrote it, actually, I wrote it cold turkey in Paris and worked on it. I never was addicted again. I mean, yeah, I've done it since then. I mean, a lot of people have done it, but it's not like I'm addicted again. I never want to be under the control of a drug again in my life.
And while Scarface came about at something of a low point in your career, you actually dedicate a number of pages in this book to talking about the intoxication of success in Hollywood and what it's like when you're the hot new golden boy in town, then you lose it and you get it back. Yeah. And you actually say that you learn as much from your successes as from your failures. I don't hear that a lot. I always hear people talk about how the hard times influenced them, but rarely do they talk about how they were shaped by their successes. What did you get out of that?
You learn from both. Failure teaches you. When you go through all the stages of failure, you know, bitterness, revenge, and acceptance, wisdom, whatever, the stages, and then success. You need it because you learn from success. People treat you different when you're successful. So you see those relationships. Mm-hmm. You understand the game of public relations, diplomacy. You understand how movies get bartered and made and blah, blah, blah. It makes it a lot simpler sometimes to deal with. Also, you can't live with constant failure. You'd be like a miserable dog. I talk about a man. Screenwriters have been working. They get their voice cut out. They get their voice boxes cut out. They no longer have confidence in what they're saying or doing. And eventually, they become conformists. They do what the studio does because they pay them, and that's the death of you. That's conformity. There's a lot of that going on.
Yeah.
Talk about it's important to have success, and it's important. Mm-hmm. And now that I've been through both, I think, you know, I recognize both and I can utilize both. Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's harder today to make a political film that's critical of the U.S. government than it was back then, post Vietnam?
Oh, sure. Ever since the Patriot Act.
Really?
Oh, it's impossible. Mm-hmm. The only film that kind of, there was a few, but it's been very difficult, you know, not that you'd set out to, but, you know, what you set out to do is tell the truth. Or at least I do a lot of research, but, you know, it's very hard to have made a JFK or I did W, which is about Bush. And I showed in a funny way, what kind of shallow presidency we had, a shallow policy, foreign policy, how we got into the Iraq War. And I think that movie was very effective for me in showing it, but there was at that time, it was a patriotic country, and they're still, I mean, we're worshiping our military to the point of madness, and it's excessive.
Yeah.
It's super worship.
Yeah.
It's jingoism.
Yeah. Yeah. I talked to Karl Rove around the time the movie came out, and I'll tell you this, he was really pissed off that you cast Toby Jones as him. He said, he's
really?
2 feet tall. I'm like 5'8" or something like that.
Oh, really?
Really pissed him off. Got him pretty good there.
Well, actually, Bush saw the movie. Clinton told me that it was right on.
Really?
I was on what he said. Right on.
Oh, I love it. Well, this has been so much fun. Before we go, real quickly, I have to ask about one story in the book. Is it true that Gore Vidal once tried to talk you and Mick Jagger into a threesome?
Oh, God, yeah. You're going for sensationalism now. It's just funny story. Gore was a very funny man. He was outrageous, and that's why we loved him. Yeah. He was outspoken.
Well, again, the book is called Chasing the Light, Writing, Directing, and Surviving Platoon, Midnight Express, Scarface, Salvador, and the Movie Game. Oliver Stone, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ben. It was fun.
Thanks again to Oliver Stone for coming on the show. Order his new book, Chasing the Light, Writing, Directing, and Surviving Platoon, Midnight Express, Scarface, Salvador, and the Movie Game on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickassNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.